Welcome to this week's podcast from Innovation Forum for Friday, 7th September, with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is the usual roundup of news and comment. Plus, as ever, we've got some great expert insight for you this episode. We are well into our Innovation Forum autumn webinar series, and coming up we have some of the highlights from a couple of weeks ago when we brought together Brent Wilton from Coca-Cola, Doug Nystrom from Walmart, and Cindy Berman from the Ethical Trading Initiative to discuss modern slavery risks at the point of recruitment. And there will also be a chance to listen again to one of our most popular interviews of 2018 when my colleague Toby Webb spoke with Mighty Earth's Glenn Hurwitz earlier this year. They talk about why soy's deforestation impacts have rather been under the radar. It's very much worth another listen. Before that, though, our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. A new report from the European Union's Agency for Fundamental Rights has uncovered yet more evidence of modern slavery in EU countries, including the UK, France, and Poland. The report says that national authorities are struggling to stop migrant workers being abused, underpaid, and overworked in sectors such as construction and agriculture. The new report highlights ineffective enforcement as a major culprit, calling on EU governments to strengthen inspection regimes to catch exploitative employers and to protect workers. The Council of Europe, for its part, says that abuse from labour trafficking is now a greater form of slavery than sexual exploitation in much of the continent. The apparel sector is, of course, another with a poor record in labour issues. And the Sustainable Apparel Coalition has announced that it is working with researchers from GlobeScan to develop better communication guidelines to engage consumers with the Higg Index, which is the coalition's suite of sustainability tools for the sector. The index has a focus on protecting the well-being of workers in the sector's often complex supply chains. Now, it seems to be a growing theme that customers are increasingly concerned about labour issues, so it will be interesting to see how this consumer engagement initiative unfolds. Elsewhere, drinks brand Lucozade joined the seemingly unstoppable march against single-use plastic this week, announcing that it will be trialling edible drink sachets at two events in England this month. The sachets, made from seaweed, will be tested for Lucozade Sport drinks and gels. The brand says it wants to gauge how acceptable edible sachets are for consumers compared to the usual plastic bottles. Lucozade's parent company, Lucozade Ribena Suntory, has a 2025 target of 100% of packaging being reusable, recyclable or compostable. If the sachets prove to be popular with competitors this month, then similar trials will be rolled out at other sporting events later this year. The sachet technology has also been trialled by online food business Just Eat as an alternative to plastic sachets for dips. And given there are 11 billion plastic ketchup, mustard and other condiment sachets used globally every year, there's a large market to crack. Climate pollution risks have not always been front and centre of concerns for the investment community, but a new bill passed by Californian state legislatures in the US would require the state's pension funds to consider climate-related financial risk when making investment decisions. The state CalPERS and CalSTRS funds for public employees and teachers, which have combined assets of $590 billion, would identify and report on salient climate risks and disclose carbon footprint and progress towards Paris Climate Change Agreement goals. The sort of risks that the funds would report on include intense storms, rising sea levels, higher global temperatures, and financial losses resulting from carbon emissions. However, the bill is yet to be signed into law by California Governor Jerry Brown, who is also considering whether to approve separate legislation that would commit his state to 100% low-emissions energy by 2045. Brown has been a public supporter of renewable energy and of measures to counter climate change, but as ever, there is a lot of politics getting in the way. Regular listeners will know that the climate change impacts of deforestation are something that we keep a close eye on at Innovation Forum, and a new pilot finance initiative will help soy farmers in Brazil preserve important virgin lands. Backed by commodities trader Bunge, Banco Santander Brazil, and the US conservation group The Nature Conservancy, the programme will initially make $50 million in loans available to farms committed to preservation in the environmentally sensitive Cerrado scrub and grasslands, a biome found outside the rainforests of Amazonia. Brazilian government data suggests that more than 105,000 square kilometres of the Cerrado have been destroyed in the past 10 years. Soy watchers say that the new finance initiative may be a response from the soy industry to pressure from environmentalists for better practices, as the demand for the commodity from the likes of China continues to rapidly grow. And do, of course, stay listening for an interview with Glenn Hurwitz from Mighty Earth for more background on this very issue. We're rapidly approaching Innovation Forum's autumn conference season. And if you register by Friday, 14th September next week, you can save €100 on passes to Innovation Forum's How Business Can Tackle Plastic Pollution conference in Amsterdam on the 16th and 17th of October. We're looking forward to joining senior business representatives from Unilever, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Ocado, Mars, Interface, Ecover, and many more. Time now for some highlights from our recent webinar, when we brought together Brent Wilton, Director of Global Workplace Rights at Coca-Cola, Doug Nystrom, Director of Human Rights Supply Chain at Walmart, and Cindy Berman, Head of Modern Slavery at the Ethical Trading Initiative, to discuss forced labour and recruitment practices.
Cindy, perhaps you could go first to set the scene around the employer pays principle, what it is aiming to achieve and why, and what trends you're seeing through the work of the ETI. Cindy.
Thank you, Ian. The employer pays principle is very simple. As you have indicated, many workers that find themselves in a situation of modern slavery have been found to pay recruitment fees. So the employer pays principle simply states that no worker should pay for their job, and that the costs of their recruitment shouldn't be borne by the worker, but should be paid by the employer. In addition, where workers have paid recruitment fees, that these need to be reimbursed to the worker as part of their right to remedy, because many of these workers end up in a situation of debt bondage, having made the decision often to migrate for jobs. They are charged by a number of recruitment agents that operate either in their local village or in a particular sector, and charge exorbitant fees. Many of the employers that are recruiting migrant workers are also paying for recruitment. And there are a number of middle men, as it were, that are reaping the benefits of this, that end up making vulnerable workers even more vulnerable because they are indebted as a result of this fee. Many of them end up paying back the recruitment fee for the first sometimes 6, 9, 12 or even 18 months of their job. So before they're actually earning an income, they are simply repaying this recruitment fee and getting themselves out of debt. The Ethical Trading Initiative, a lot of our members are recognizing this as an important risk to them in relation to their modern slavery obligations. The UK Modern Slavery Act requires that companies produce a modern slavery statement, but the UK is not alone. There are many other legislative requirements now on transparency and due diligence that are prompting companies to think very hard about the workers that they have in their supply chain, even fairly deep down their supply chain, and to consider what they need to do. And a number of our corporate members have signed up to the Leadership Group on Responsible Recruitment. Many of them have spearheaded efforts at the Consumer Goods Forum. We are heavily engaged in the Sustainable Development Goal 8.7 with the ILO and other international forums to try to address this as a collaborative effort. It does involve quite a lot of collaboration, as well as really understanding what the issues are in each context and ensuring that we're not simply taking a face value approach to this issue and trying to understand what were the drivers and the mechanisms and how to address what is an endemic risk in many supply chains.
Thank you, Cindy. Just going back to the levels of fees, you said that it takes up to 12 months sometimes for workers to pay back the fees. So what sort of level of fee are we talking about then for these workers?
It varies a lot. In some places, Bangladeshi workers, for example, have paid something like $3,000, which is well over what the average wage is in Bangladesh. And they have managed to raise that money either through the family mortgaging their land, through using money lenders, through taking out a debt through their recruitment agents. In other places, it's a bit lower. And obviously, the type of work that those workers are going to do when they are abroad varies considerably. So some have been deceived into being told that they will be earning considerably higher wages than they actually will be. And then it's going to take them a much longer period of time if they end up in a very low paid job, for example, as a construction worker in the Gulf States or a domestic worker, it will take them a very long time to repay those wages. I mean, the recruitment fee, because their wages are extremely low. But it does vary, and some countries have really taken important steps to limit the amount that any worker can earn abroad. For example, in the Philippines, they have very clear standards, for example, for care workers about what they should be earning abroad, and have very clear benchmarks about whether workers are permitted to pay any kind of recruitment fee. But in many other countries, governments have simply failed to take responsibility for regulating recruitment fees in the recruitment industry.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Brent, turning to you, perhaps you could outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Coca-Cola and what the employer pays principle means for your business in particular.
Yeah, thanks, Ian, and thanks to the Innovation Forum for including me in this panel. I think Cindy has started off this discussion setting a very clear framework within which we're all trying to address this vexing issue around human trafficking, modern slavery. For us, we've been dealing with this space for a number of years, and initially we engaged around the issue of retention of passports. That was the first big tranche of work that we did back in about 2011. And then, of course, with changes here in the US around federal contracting with Obama's Executive Order 13627 and then federal acquisition regulations coming into play in 2015, it meant that we had to get ahead of the issue. And one of those issues was the payment of fees, because, of course, as Cindy said, this is often the catalyst by which people then get trapped into a lifetime of misery and debt bondage. So we moved very quickly around 2012 to do some survey work within some of our markets where we knew that there were corridors of migrant labor. And this was for us particularly in the Gulf. So we went out and did a survey with a third party just to see what the instances were in terms of the legal environment. And of course, what we found was that in many of those countries and in other countries today, local law actually allows for the charging of fees. So you've got an immediate challenge when you're dealing with suppliers, particularly local suppliers in those markets, who believe that they are legally entitled to do what they are doing. And I think Cindy's point about cooperation and engaging with governments to get them to start changing the way in which they regulate their migration policy is very, very important to help companies operate in a better environment where the charging of fees is outlawed. And I think we're seeing a trend towards that, but it's incredibly slow. And so as a company, we decided to take a principled approach with regards to these issues. And we put them together with regards to both non-payment of recruitment fees, and that includes transportation fees, bringing people to or from a country. We also included making sure that contracts of employment were presented in a clear and truthful manner, and that copies of those contracts that people signed are kept and available for inspection. We also do the requirement that people have access to their identity documents. And we require our bottling system and also our suppliers to have in place management systems which ensure that those obligations are met on an ongoing basis. We also, of course, undertake a third-party auditing of our business in order to ensure that these issues are addressed. But it's not perfect everywhere. There are still challenges in those countries that do allow for fees to be charged, particularly within our suppliers. But we're doing a lot of work on a collaborative basis with other brands such as Walmart in order to get out amongst the community of suppliers to the world's transnational businesses to understand that this desire to move away from the model whereby people pay for a job is something that not just the Coca-Cola company or Walmart or Mars or one individual company expects, but all of us expect. And that if a supplier wants to enter into the global supply chain of any of these large brands, then they need to position themselves to make sure that they are not charging fees for people working in their business.
Thank you, Brent. Point around confusion, I think, is an interesting one. To what extent do you find that there are companies in where you're operating or you have supply chains where such recruitment fees are indeed against the law or illegal, but they are still being charged?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue that you've always got the black market. And that's why one of the things we're trying to do with the leadership group and the employer pays principle is trying to shift the recruitment market. We're trying to identify those recruiters that exist in any market that are not charging fees and to steer business towards them and to move business away from those who support the payment of fees. But this isn't easy either because it depends very much on what the buyer of those services requires. And we've seen instances with one recruiter where they'll do no fees, they'll do partial fees, or they'll do full fees, depending upon what the client wants. And so the game for us as well is not just to shift the recruitment market, but through the collaboration exercises, and Cindy mentioned the CGF and the Consumer Goods Forum and the leadership group, is to shift businesses to understand that this is something they're going to have to correct and that they cannot persist in doing what is illegal in those instances where fees should not be charged. And then again, you have to be very mindful that these things morph over time. So, for example, when we had the issue around retention of documents, passports were returned, but other legal documentation was seized. And so you've got to continuously, like whack-a-mole, go around and make sure that you're addressing through the systems you have in place, morphing within the industry, so that we are able to get a firm hand on no charging of fees.
Thanks, Brent. It strikes me that this is an area where a lot of collaboration is possible between brands and companies. Doug, I'd like to turn to you now. Put the same questions I put to Brent to you. So perhaps you can outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Walmart and what the employer pays principle means for your business.
Just to help everybody understand the Walmart context, if you don't already, we're large, largest private employer in the world, largest company by revenues with $500 billion. 2.3 million associates. We're in 28 countries, 11,700 and something stores. That's 54% of our stores are outside the U.S. So given that context, you would think, well, you could just do it yourself. But I want to just come back to the point that's already been made and say that in this area, especially, collaboration is critical. This cannot be done by any one company. There are too many complexities to the way workers are recruited. There's too many government issues, there's different suppliers, there's different sectors. And so as a company like Walmart, who crosses electronics, apparel, food and beverage sectors, we can kind of be a convener or be kind of a bridge to different sectors and kind of bring them into this tent, so to speak. So on our journey, similar to what Brent was saying, you know, we've decided a couple of years ago that the way to combat forced labor was through the recruitment of migrant workers and through the employer pays principle. And so we joined the leadership group for responsible recruitment. We're also part of the Consumer Goods Forum that's already been mentioned as well. I sit on the steering committee for the Responsible Labor Initiative, which comes out of the electronics industry, but is broader than that. It's open to non-electronics as well. And they're doing some good work in this area. On the government side, we're part of the Bali Process Government and Business Forum, where we're interacting with the governments in the region of South Southeast Asia to discuss human trafficking, forced labor, and we're putting recruitment of workers as a key part of that agenda. And that just the second meeting just took place in August in Bali, Indonesia. So there's a collaborative piece where it's absolutely critical to the success of this. Individually, we've added it to our standards. So we've embedded the recruitment of workers and the payment of fees by the employer into our supplier standards. We are focusing as a member of the leadership group on Malaysia and Thailand. And so within those two countries, we're working with the International Organization for Migration to map out our supply chain and then dig into where the labor is coming from in those two countries and then do some training of the employers and of the workers and then even of the labor brokers. We're working with the ITSER Institute as well through our foundation. We funded them and They ended up creating an app for workers from Myanmar to Thailand so that they can kind of rate labor brokers and kind of share their experiences, so that kind of like Yelp, you can kind of find who's a good labor broker, who's not. We're also doing some other data things with them, some responsible recruitment work of employers so that they're trained. We're also, some of our supply chain is going through a program that the Responsible Labor Initiative is also putting on, called the Responsible Workplace Program, where employers, workers are being surveyed, and employers and workers are having training to try to move them to a place where they understand how this should operate and to become more satisfied in their work as well. You know, it's part of audits. We have third-party audits. We have different audit schemes that are approved. You know, that's sort of the first line. You know, where, how do you find it? Hopefully we can find it in audits, you know, and we're working with these audit schemes like SMETA at SEDEX, like BSCI, ICTI, RAP, the Responsible Business Alliance audit. And we're trying to get them to come together and actually do a job of finding the fees, finding the problems in a better way. We have training portal for our suppliers, and we've embedded responsible recruitment training into that so that suppliers have access to that. We have in our department close to 200 associates around the world, and a lot of those are actually engaging with suppliers. And so they follow up, they will visit facilities, they work with our sourcing teams and try to find this. We also have an investigation team that if allegations do come up, they can go in and actually verify those and find out if they're true or not. But all that to say, this is a complex problem. Simple solution is that the employer should pay, but getting to that point is going to take a huge effort and collaboration. I believe in that, you know, we've got to come with one voice across sectors, across suppliers, across retailers, across brands like Coca-Cola, and have that same voice so that it doesn't be like whack-a-mole, as Brent was commenting, so that we can actually, if it pops up in our supply chain and we get it and then it moves over to somebody else's, they have the same voice and the same requirements.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Doug. Let's go back to Cindy in a sec, but Doug, with you for now, when a company is moving then to a employer pays principle and trying to get rid of worker paying recruitment fees, what are the immediate challenges that making such a move throws up?
First challenge is finding it. The audit process doesn't necessarily always find it. You know, there can be ways of hiding it. There can be imperfections in the audit process. And so that's why we're working with these audit schemes to improve that. I think sometimes the quality of auditors as well. So finding it is key. If you think about it, it's an economic problem. We're trying to disrupt a business model and replace it with a totally different business model and that's got incentives and motivations built into it, and they can be different from place to place. But quite simply, it's a supply and demand. And so right now, if you tell your supplier, recruit responsibly, they're going to want to go find a responsible labor broker. That supply has to be increased as well. They got to be able to find one. And so there's a challenge there that is still in its nascent stage, so that they can't necessarily identify who those responsible labor brokers are. And then I think a big challenge is the government, the regulations, the lack of enforcement, the cultural differences from one country to another. Going beyond the government, more of the culture, I think that's another challenge, where one culture may view people from another country a different way. And then I'll throw out one more challenge, and that's the workers. The workers, in our experience, they don't trust that you don't pay for a job. And so there has to be some education on their part. And I mean, it makes sense to me, too. I mean, I don't know that I would trust that I don't have to pay to get a job in another country. But we've got to be able to educate them and tell them, no, that's the way it's going to be now.
And now, as promised, here's a chance to listen again to one of our most popular interviews this year, recorded a few months ago at the Nature Conservancy during Innovation Forum's Business and Deforestation Conference, my colleague Toby Webb with Mighty Earth's Glenn Horowitz.
Mighty Earth has been doing a variety of different campaigns since your inception a few years ago, but what we wanted to talk about on this one is soy specifically, because it seems to us that soy is a commodity in the deforestation debate, which has been slightly under the radar for a few years. Now, I know a lot's been happening in the last couple of years, but it does seem as if the campaigns to get soy sustainable are running up against some pretty large barriers. Tell us what you think those barriers are, Glenn.
Well, those barriers really have names, because it's only two of them. It's really Bunge and Cargill. And I don't say that in the way that we're just singling out companies as markets campaigners do. If you look at the companies that are actually driving deforestation on the ground and sustainability, it's those two companies. The other major players in the soy industry have actually been relatively proactive. So Louis Dreyfus is working on a strict no deforestation policy for soy. They already don't really source from areas that have much deforestation. ADM has done a lot, although it is pulling back, and TFT has recently stopped working with them on soy. So we're a little worried about that. And Wilmar, which is known primarily as a palm oil company, is actually the largest buyer of soy from Latin America. And their strong no deforestation, no exploitation policy applies to soy as well. What we do see is that if you look in the Brazilian Cerrado, for instance, it's not everybody driving deforestation. On the frontier, almost all the deforestation is happening in areas where either Bunge or Cargill has silos. And we just completed a huge investigation that got coverage all over Europe into how European soy end users, the big meat and dairy companies, are getting soy from areas where Cargill and Bunge and a couple others are driving large-scale deforestation. And so if we can persuade Cargill and Bunge to stop, we're confident that the rest of the soy industry will come along.
And what are their objections to doing anything? Because these are companies who are no strangers to sustainability. Yep. They've been at the forefront of campaigns and I would say also of some proactive activity for 10, 15 years or more. What's the problem on soy from their point of view, as far as you understand it?
You put your finger on it because this is the thing that drives me crazy. Bunge and Cargill themselves created the most successful example of private sector action to protect forests in the world.
The Amazon soy moratorium.
Brazilian Amazon soy moratorium. Wildly successful. Virtually eliminated deforestation for soy in the Brazilian Amazon. And meanwhile, because there's 1.6 trillion acres of degraded land in the world, they've been able to hugely expand the area planted with soy in the Brazilian Amazon, detoxify the Brazilian Amazon soy industry in global marketplace. So it's been a win-win-win. The only problem with it is that it's confined to the Brazilian Amazon. These same companies, Bunge and Cargill, are driving massive deforestation in the Cerrado. There's massive deforestation going on in Argentina, Paraguay. And the Bolivian Amazon, which is just over the border from Brazil, is the same ecosystem, has sloths and scarlet macaws and all the things that make rainforest great. But because it's in Bolivia, has zero protection from these companies.
If they were here now, what would they be saying, do you think? Let's think about it really from their point of view. What would they be saying? What would they say in response to those accusations?
What they say now is we recognize that it is possible to expand on degraded lands. I mean, they've done it in the Brazilian Amazon. They're doing it in palm oil as well. And Cargill is participating in the cocoa and forest initiative. So they have a lot of experience with success. The reason why they defend the Brazilian Cerrado in particular as being a special little snowflake is they say that there's opposition from the growers. And these guys, what we found is 50,000 hectare, 100,000 hectare farms being completely cleared of all native vegetation and replaced with soy. These are very well-financed actors. This is not a smallholder sector like cocoa. This is serious commercial commodity.
Companies like Maggi, for example?
Maggi, although even they are soy positively oriented. It's a lot of like companies people haven't heard of, but are large. And in Argentina, when we went out and did our investigation, what we found was that the owners of the land of these farms were not farmers in the traditional sense. They weren't there. They had some workers there. They lived in Buenos Aires. It was supported by international capital.
So these are not the sort of romantic smallholders of palm oil.
Yeah, right. It's more like the massive palm oil plantation, Corindo, Pasco, Daewoo, international companies.
So let's say you get what you want.
Yeah.
You can't tell me that's going to solve the soy sustainability problem if Bunge and Cargill say, oh, okay, Glenn, we'll do what you guys want and we'll do what we did in the Amazon in a much, much bigger area that's far more prone to leakage, even though it's very difficult, we'll try and do it. So you get what you want in terms of objectives.
Yeah.
That isn't going to solve the soy sustainability problem, is it?
It solves the deforestation problem. And they've shown that they can do it. Within 3 years in the Brazilian Amazon, which is a vast area, they virtually eliminated deforestation. They took it from 25% of Amazon deforestation to 0.25% in 3 years.
So you don't think it's that hard to be done in the Cerrado or the...
We don't see any difference. I mean, when we look at it, you've got basically the same dynamics. One of the things the companies will say, I think, frankly, dishonestly, they say, well, there's a lot of players, there's a lot of competition. If a soy grower wants to go around us, they can. They leave out the fact that that's true in the part of the Cerrado that's well-established agriculture. But that's not true where the deforestation is happening on the frontier. We and the University of Wisconsin has done great analysis to show that where deforestation is happening, it's almost all Bunge silos and Cargill silos. I think one of the things for your listeners to understand, in palm oil, the main relationship that the traders have with their suppliers is they purchase it. And that gives them responsibility, and they've now taken a degree of responsibility for that. In soy, Cargill and Bunge are buying, yes, but they're providing financing, they're providing fertilizer, they're providing infrastructure. They are the ones determining where deforestation happens. What we're asking them is to stop doing that and also just monitor where deforestation occurs and do exactly what they're doing in Brazilian soy. Just say, we're not going to buy your deforestation. You know, the great thing is I met with CEOs of large Chinese companies that are buying soy, and they're committed to stepping in and doing their part. So we've got these two American companies.
We had a conversation this morning about Kofco, I mentioned.
Yeah.
I've been in touch with someone recently who said, you know, there were sort of two people at Kofco who were both about 12 doing sustainability. I mean, these other companies don't necessarily cover themselves in glory historically, do they? I mean,
so Wilmar, which remains, despite some challenges, the leader on driving conservation on palm oil, is also the largest buyer of soy from Latin America.
I just got back
from Singapore, and I'll say they are fully committed. They've been participating in all these
initiatives. Wilmar, we know about. I was thinking more about the Chinese.
But Kofco, well, so Kofco is the other. So yeah. Wilmar's, you know, is the main company that sells to China. They're the leader.
Okay.
And then on soy, too. And Kofco, the Chinese state-owned company, so their CEO came to Davos and said, we're going to protect high conservation value and high carbon stock forests. So we support that. They've done very little to nothing to implement it as far as we know. However, from what we understand, the Chinese government does not want to be embarrassed by things like deforestation or abuse of human rights, especially in land deals. And Kofco is right on the firing line. And their CEO is basically a civil servant. And he's held to account when they show up in newspapers and are embarrassed. The other interesting thing about Kofco, and I think consumer companies should be aware of this, is we approached them a few years ago about palm oil and got nowhere. Since then, they've acquired two major international soy traders, Nidera and Noble, which also do palm oil. And so suddenly, we now find in our analysis that Kofco is selling to international brands like Burger King and Nestle, etc. And that means that if they want to keep expanding internationally, they're going to have to be responsive to sustainability concerns. So I'm decently optimistic that if the American companies take responsibility, the Chinese ones will do so too.
So let's talk about the politics and the consumer sentiment around this. We've seen an awful lot of noise in the last 6 months, going back years, but particularly in the last 6 months, around palm oil in Europe.
Yeah.
We saw campaigns, European members of parliament, saying ban palm oil, get rid of palm oil. And then we saw big pushback in the Malaysian, Indonesian press talking about colonialism and impoverishing smallholders and, you know, the usual arguments. And then we saw a big UK retailer, if not international, Iceland, not the country, listeners, the retailer, saying that they were going to dump palm oil from their own brand products. And we'd been expecting this kind of announcement from somebody for ages, and lots of people are quite sceptical and critical about it. Nevertheless, it seems palm oil is getting a pretty bad name. Do you think soy has the same potential? I mean, they're both ubiquitous in things we eat in particular, but in palm oil's case also in cosmetics. Do you see soy going down the same road as palm oil in terms of being...
Absolutely. And I think it's great that companies like Iceland are sending a signal they don't want to buy palm oil anymore. It sends a really powerful signal to the palm oil industry that they need to clean up their act. The same thing is already happening in soy. McDonald's is exploring soy alternatives, like even, you know, protein sources for livestock like insects, which is actually what chickens normally eat, are insects. So it's more natural. In addition, we are seeing, I think, partly as a result of the environmental problems with meat, and chief among them deforestation, that there is a lot of investment in vegan alternatives. The Impossible Burger, which has massive venture capital investment and is being eaten enthusiastically wherever you can get it. There's not enough supply to meet the demand, as well as investment in cellular agriculture. And these are existential threats to at least part of the meat industry. And it's definitely an existential threat to the soy industry because these things do not need soy to grow. What I can't comprehend is why Cargill and Bunge went through the experience of having their product be so toxic when campaigns more than 10 years ago were launched about what they were doing in the Brazilian Amazon. That is happening now in Europe in particular. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about that 12 years ago. I remember it very well.
Yeah.
I was running a magazine on corporate responsibility. I knew Greenpeace pretty well. I got slightly tipped off something was happening. 2006, I go in the office and I get a press release from Greenpeace showing their activists dressed as chickens, handcuffing themselves inside McDonald's outlets. And McDonald's really moved the needle very quickly. Why isn't there a big brand doing that now on soy?
So 61 of the world's leading soy end users have called for an end to deforestation in the Brazilian Cerrado. That's McDonald's, Walmart, Unilever, Nestle.
But are they holding the stick over these companies?
Well, that's a great question.
Back then, because that seemed to be what happened back then. There was a big stick held up and then things happened. Now they're signing pledges, but they're still buying.
That is exactly right. So if you're the CEO of McDonald's, I think my question to you is, are you serious? Because it's one thing to put your name on a piece of paper and say you're exploring alternatives to soy and perhaps using some of them.
Yeah, but those aren't coming to scale anytime soon, are they?
It's another thing to say, we're not going to buy as much from Bunge and Cargill. And in palm oil, the thing that moved the palm oil companies to do everything that they have done was the fact that these companies threatened, and in some cases did actually move their volumes from a responsible producer, or from an irresponsible producer to a responsible producer. Mm-hmm. We have not seen much evidence of that happening in soy. I think if you saw McDonald's and Tesco and others actually saying, we're going to stop either ourselves or our meat suppliers are going to shift away from Cargill and Bunge because of the egregious, massive deforestation they're doing in South America, those companies would adopt very quickly. And you asked earlier, what would Cargill and Bunge say? One of the things they say is that in Brazil in particular, there's this kind of right-wing political resistance. And that's true to an extent. But let's not forget, the reason why we're focusing on the private sector is because governments have failed to act so much. And because of political dynamics that we have right here in the United States as well. Mm. But they still have a responsibility to provide their customers, including the companies and the individuals, with the sustainable products that they increasingly want. Mm-hmm. And I think we should not forget that Cargill and Bunge are financing the trade associations that are creating this political polarization, that are the ones objecting to very basic, easy conservation. We put together a proposal with all the other NGOs and experts saying you can replicate the success of the Brazilian soy moratorium across soy growing areas in Latin America for less than $1 million a year.
Well, I hope that's true, and I hope they come to the table. A final question. If you get what you want and they agree with those numbers and it happens, does that end soy's threat to be a deforesting commodity?
I think the crazy thing is yes. Because we've seen it work already in the Brazilian Amazon.
There's nowhere else in the world.
There's very limited quantities of soy grown in other... I mean, I should say, and we are working a lot on this too, as you may know, in the United States...
There are different sustainability problems.
Clearing the native prairie, they're polluting with fertilizer, and those remain issues in South America. So I don't mean to diminish...
But they're not deforestation.
But it's not... Yeah, I mean, it's clearance of native prairie, which is similar. And we're making some progress here on that, but a lot more to do. So rightly, North America has a lot to do as well. And, you know, we're seeing some of the big meat companies like Tyson start to take action in North America. But in terms of deforestation... With 1.6 trillion acres of degraded land across Latin America, you don't need to deforest. Mm. And the studies have shown that indeed there's usually a financial advantage to planting on degraded land. You know, there's inertia. These companies have existing relationships, or they aspire to relationships with certain people who are politically connected and own big properties. And, you know, it's a very narrow financial motivation that drives that. But there's a war going on within Cargill and Bunge right now. The people who try to sell soy to the global market are pissed off that they're being embarrassed and they're being yelled at by their customers. The people who buy soy from the growers in South America are much more accommodationist. And ultimately, this is the type of situation where a CEO has to decide. Are we a political entity that exists to kiss up to people who are doing terrible things? Do we want to give veto authority to those who are committing environmental and human rights crimes? Or do we want to be a successful business that expands our market share and understands the sustainability revolution that's happening? That's a bottom line business calculation for two companies that are under threat for being less and less relevant in an era when people want to know where their food comes from, and that it's produced in a manner consistent with their values.
Okay, well, let's see how this plays out.
Yeah.
Glenn, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And of course, Glenn Hurwitz and experts from Bunge and Cargill will all be at Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes event in London on the 6th and 7th of November. I hope you can join us. And don't forget to sign up before the end of next week for a discount on passes to our business and plastic pollution event in Amsterdam on 16th and 17th of October. A quick reminder that Innovation Forum will also be in Detroit for our next event on business impact and measurement on the 2nd and 3rd of October, and we'll be debating human rights and modern slavery in London on the 18th and 19th of October. That's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. I'll be back next week, and until then, goodbye.